Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome investigative reporter and filmmaker Sue Wilson to talk about the corporate media, its government regulators, and your rights as media consumers, as Sue Wilson reminds us, about putting the public back into broadcasters' public interest obligations. She'll talk about some of her bigger cases over the years, and we'll get an update on the FCC challenges for Sinclair Broadcasting. Wrapping up the program today, we welcome back Nolan Higdon, author of The Anatomy of Fake News, The Critical News Literacy Education. There's been a lot of buzz around a new HBO documentary called After Truth. Nolan Higdon joins the program to talk about his review of that film and why he thinks that it amounts to little more than corporate news propaganda. Up next on the Project Censored Show, an hour of media analysis. Stay with us. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you probably own the. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome Sue Wilson, writer, producer, director of Public Interest Pictures documentary on the media, Broadcast Blues. Sue Wilson tells important stories via film, TV, radio, and online content, which move politicians to act. Her Emmy-winning stories at KCBS-TV and KTXL-TV changed national, state, and local spending policies. Her story of pharmaceuticals appearing in drinking water forced the U.S. EPA to begin testing. And her award-winning NPR radio show Healing Healthcare at KXJZ helped put more nurses on the job in California. Broadcast Blues sets its sights on media policy. And www.suewilsonreports.com turns a critical eye on the media itself. Sue founded the Media Action Center to employ every legal means available to hold broadcasters accountable to the public interest. In 2017, Media Action Center forced Entercom to surrender its $13.5 million broadcast license for its 2007 killing of Jennifer Strange in an on-air contest. We're going to be talking with Sue Wilson today. She's going to be talking about some updated work that's happening involving Sinclair. Sue Wilson, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
I am so pleased to be on with you, Mickey Huff, and Project Censored does some of the best work in the country, and I'm grateful for it.
That's very kind of you. We are delighted to have you here at Project Censored, and I'm very grateful that we're able to connect here on the show today. You have such a long and really amazing career that you've worked behind the scenes with your media activism, going back to Broadcast Blues. Tell our listeners a little bit about your work and your history.
My whole focus on media reform really started after the 1996 Telecommunications Act. I had been working at KCBS-TV the day the Fairness Doctrine went away. Now, that goes way back. But it took about until 1998, after the 1996 Telecommunications Act put virtually every radio station in the hands of right-wing broadcasters. It took me until the Clinton impeachment to see the effect of that, to see how we went from reasoned discussion on the radio to a screeching, one-sided, right-wing attack on any Democrat. At that point, the Democrat was Bill Clinton. And at that point, I understood that if we did not change media policy in this country, we were going to end up with a president one day that would be unthinkable. And here we are. So I continued with my career. It was about 2005 when I finally said, I have to do more. I have to make a movie. I have to tell people what has happened here and why, and encourage people to act. If we can educate people, if we can get people to understand what has happened and that we actually do have power to put pressure on the system, we can change things. Providing that we can actually get our Democratic Congress people involved. They have turned a blind eye to this for too many years, but it is possible. And I think finally today, finally, people are waking up, and I think that the Democratic establishment is waking up and going, oh, perhaps media really does matter. Perhaps disinformation does matter. So let me tell you a little bit, if I can, about Broadcast Blues. I made Broadcast Blues starting in 2005, and it came out in 2009. And I want people to go to that site. It's on YouTube right now, and I have it linked at both SueWilsonReports.com and MediaActionCenter.net. It really is a very simple historical tale of here's what happened with policy. Never forget, we are in the disinformation age due to very poor public policy, poor public policy that Republicans dreamt up decades ago, and finally were victorious in getting through the Congress. You can draw a direct line from very poor public policy to where we are today. So it's a historical record, and it shows what happened as a result. In fact, Peter Phillips of Project Censored is featured in Broadcast Blues. He is talking about the infamous case of Dane Acree, who filed a whistleblower suit against a Fox station in Tampa Bay, Florida. What happened there was that she had a story that they were injecting cattle in that state with BGH, bovine growth hormone, that scientists were saying is causing cancer. She and her husband did an investigative piece, very lengthy, and they were ready to go with it on the air when Roger Ailes himself stepped in and said, oh no, you can't air this story. And at that point, the Fox station pressured and repressured these reporters to change their tune to the point that they were basically going to be lying on the air, and they said, I won't do it. If you make me do it, I'm going to report you to the FCC. And they got fired. So they filed a whistleblower suit. And Mickey, a court in Florida listened to the whole case and found that indeed the Fox station had engaged in news distortion, that they had basically told them, you are going to distort this news. She won that case. And on appeal, Fox came back and argued, well, there is no law that says you can't do that. It's an FCC rule that says you can't distort the rule, but there's no law here that says you can't distort the news. So as Peter said in that interview so aptly, you know, what they're really saying here is not against the law to lie to the public. So bear that in mind, everyone, as you're watching these news shows. There is no law against lying to the public. And on the Fox News side, well, I think we all have a sense of what that really means. So I exposed all of that kind of thing in 2005, but there was one really key story in there. In 2007, I was still making Broadcast Blues, and folks, it takes typically 4 years to make a documentary film, and that's what it took me. I came home on an airplane to Sacramento, and the headline in the paper was that a woman locally at an Entercom radio station had been killed in a water drinking contest. And I think a lot of people will remember this. A lot of people thought, well, you know, she was really stupid. But wait a second. You got this great big radio station, and they're hyping this radio contest. Come on in. We're going to give you a Nintendo Wii if you win. And in those days, that was the it Christmas gift. And they called the contest, Hold Your Wii to Win a Wii. Well, she and many others went in. It was shortly after Christmas at that point, a very cold January morning, and they did this contest. This was a contest that was actually put out by radio stations collectives that tell people, here's radio stations, here's some contests you can run. They recommended that you give people 8 ounces of water every 15 minutes, because 8 ounces of water every 15 minutes is safe. But what happened in this radio show was that they only had a 3-hour radio show. The contest would end when the last person had to go to the bathroom. And one by one, they either got really sick, they were vomiting into waste baskets while the staff was taking pictures and laughing and posting them online and making fun of them on the radio, or they were running to the bathroom. But they knew they couldn't get through this in just that amount of time. So they gave them twice that much water. They were giving them 16 ounces every 15 minutes, and that's deadly. Now, Entercom rules said that you had to have a nurse present if you were going to do any kind of a physical contest, but of course they didn't do that there. And they also were supposed to have given them a release form, Well, they drafted a release form that really said this contest could be dangerous and spelled some of those things out, except that they hid that release form and gave them just a standard release form that says, you know, I release a liability for being in this contest. At the same time, now all these people are in there. They're getting sick. And they're on the radio. They're being made fun of. Nurses are calling and going, this is dangerous. You could kill somebody doing this. But the people in the contest couldn't hear the radio show. They didn't know nurses were calling in. They had no idea that there was any danger. You know, long story short, Jennifer Strange was second in line. There was another woman who actually won the contest. But Jennifer sat in that lobby sick as she could be, and she told the host of that radio show, she said, I don't think I can drive home. I'm really sick. He says, you'll be all right. Just sit here a little while. You'll be all right. Well, she drove home, and she died a few hours later. And some of her coworkers called the radio station and said, there's a problem here. Jennifer died. You need to call some of these contestants and let them know their lives could be at risk. What did the radio station do? They called lawyers. They didn't call contestants. And it turned out that they knew that many years ago up in Chico, there had been a man who had died from water drinking at a fraternity stunt. They knew. They knew. The family took them to court, and because I live in the Sacramento area, I was able to cover this trial, and you can see that coverage on SueWilsonReports.com. The jury awarded them, I believe it was $13.5 million. I think that's what the number was. So the family got an award, but of course, Entercom's insurance paid that award. So Entercom itself really paid no price at all. Now, that contest happened in 2007. People need to realize that we, the people, own the radio airwaves. It was decided that since the air is owned by everyone, if somebody wants to utilize those airwaves, they have to serve the public interest. That's the whole foundation of broadcasting. And ladies and gentlemen, this is why I focus on broadcasting, because this is one media where you and I have rights. We have rights as the owners of the broadcast airwaves. And keep that in mind as we go along. Back in the old days, these people have to be licensed. If you want to be licensed to get a radio station, you have to serve the public interest, and you have to show sufficient character in order to serve the public interest. You can't be a murderer and run a radio station. They don't let you do that. And this is going to be key when we start to talk about Sinclair. But back in those days, every 3 years, a station would reapply to be relicensed. And in those days, they had to prove in many different ways that they were serving the public interest. Well, back in, I'm going to say the mid-2000s, the rule changed. Instead of every 3 years, they changed it to once every 8 years. That's how often a station would have to apply for a license. That's a long time. Well, it turned out that the radio station killed Jennifer in 2007. But that license didn't come up for renewal for another 6 years. It was 2 years into their license renewal period when they hosted this contest. So I had to wait until 2013 to draft a petition to deny their license. Now, I want people to understand this, too. You got 8 years in the license period. If you want to challenge that license, you only basically have 30 days at the very end. So anyone who's going to challenge a license, and by the way, those license challenges are available to be done right now. I won't get into all that. It's way too much. But I want to get this concept out that these guys run roughshod for 8 years, and if somebody wants to challenge a license, they've got about a 30-day window in order to do it. So I met that deadline. I did it on the very last day of October on 2013. Challenging that license, basically saying, how can you be serving the public interest and kill somebody on the air? Now, this gentleman we're going to be talking about in a few minutes, who has done heroic work with challenging the licenses of Sinclair, helped me with this license challenge. He took all of my research. I mean, I basically did all the research and legal work and got affidavits and all of that and put it together. But he was kind enough to put it in legal form and give it some legal citing, make it look like it was done by a lawyer and, you know, give it a little bit of teeth. But he told me then, you know, this is not going to go anywhere. But it's a good thing to do. It's a great thing to do. You got to do it. Well, my gosh, here it was 3 years later. I'm standing in the foyer of my niece's home in North Dakota, and I get a call from Art Bellenduck. He says, you're not going to believe this, but this thing's going to trial. The Federal Communications Commission took this case seriously. They actually spent more time on it and did more research on it than I had ever done. And there is a hearing designation order, if anyone ever wants to look it up, that really brought out the details of how heinous this contest was, how heinous Intercom's behavior was. It was really a piece of work.
I just wanted to remind our listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, and we're speaking with Sue Wilson, writer, producer, and director of Public Interest Pictures documentary on the media, Broadcast Blues. Also, the force behind SueWilsonReports.com, news and commentary about the corporate media, its governmental regulations, and your rights as media consumers, which is what we're talking about today on the Project Censored Show. We've been hearing some history of the cases and things that Sue Wilson has been involved in. And after this brief musical break, we're going to return, and she's going to talk to us about Sinclair Broadcasting as well. So if you're interested in hearing more about governmental regulators and how you can get involved in pushing the FCC to actually uphold their own guidelines, please stay tuned for Sue Wilson. You can learn more at SueWilsonReports.com. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, in this segment, we're speaking with Sue Wilson from SueWilsonReports.com, news and commentary about the corporate media, its governmental regulators, and your rights as media consumers. Sue Wilson is also founder of the Media Action Center, MediaActionCenter.net, putting the public back into broadcasters' public interest obligations. Sue Wilson, thank you so much for that history of several major and important cases and things that you have been involved in your work to hold the FCC accountable in order for them to hold broadcasters accountable for what belongs to the people, the public airwaves. So, Sue Wilson, before the break, you were talking about this case, the water drinking case with Jennifer Strange. I'm sorry I had to interrupt you for a quick station ID, but please continue where you were going. You were talking about your connection with his attorney, and I know this eventually is going to lead into more current affairs at a very fascinating case that you've been reporting about regarding Sinclair Broadcasting, which is another conservative network. So go ahead, Sue Wilson.
For those who maybe missed it, there was a petition to deny the licenses of KDND, an Intercom station in Sacramento, because they killed somebody. And it was like, it's a pretty low bar, but really, will the FCC allow a station to kill somebody and still be licensed? The answer was maybe not. They did call a hearing, which is basically a trial. Intercom ended up folding, which was a tremendous victory, really, because everybody said to me, you can't do it. No one ever succeeds in these license challenges. It can't be done. I think I'm counting this as a big success. And the only reason that they did fold was because Intercom at that point was merging with CBS Radio. And they knew that I would be at the FCC flogging them over killing a woman on the air at the exact same time they were trying to merge with CBS Radio. And rather than fight me, they gave up that $13.5 million license. It proves something. It proves that we, the people, actually do have power when it comes to broadcasting. Everyone remember that. Now, there's another case. This one goes back to attorney Art Bellenduck. Art is a Republican attorney in Washington, D.C., who began to understand that Sinclair has been breaking all of the rules. And this is a fellow who just very simply says, if the rules are what they are, and Sinclair cannot continue to do what they're doing. You might remember that Sinclair had a merger with Tribune that went astray. And the reason it went astray was because this FCC, and I have to credit Ajit Pai, the Republican head of the FCC, for calling Sinclair out. What happened was in their merger, they talked about two stations that they wanted to transfer to, I believe it was Cunningham Broadcasting, and another station that we all know as Superstation WGN, which they had completely undervalued. That kind of raised some hackles at the FCC, and Ajit Pai called a hearing. Now, understand, a hearing is a public trial. What happened there was Sinclair immediately withdrew its merger application with Tribune. The reason that the Tribune-Sinclair merger went down was that Sinclair understood that its character was going to be examined. And if Sinclair was found to have insufficient character to have one broadcast license, it means they have insufficient character to have any broadcast licenses. And they knew that it was better to scuttle a Tribune merger that was worth millions and millions of dollars than it was to lose all their licenses. So, bye-bye Sinclair Tribune merger. But something interesting happened months later. It took a while for the bureaucracy at the FCC to release the case. But there was an administrative law judge named Jane Halperin. When she finally dismissed the application in March of last year, she said, and I'm going to give you a quote, "The misrepresentation or lack of candor allegations raised in this proceeding is warranted as a more general assessment of Sinclair's basic character qualifications to be a commission licensee. Certainly, the behavior of a multiple station owner before the commission may be so fundamental to a licensee's operation that it is relevant to its qualifications to hold any station license." Now, let me cut through that for you. What she's really saying is, if you lie to the FCC, it shows you don't have character, and if you don't have character, you can't be a broadcaster. She further recommended that this be examined in a public hearing in the future, a license challenge or something else. Well, instead of doing a license challenge hearing or actually investigating this in the public, the Federal Communications Commission bureaucracy, and this is where the real power lies, it isn't with the commissioners, and it doesn't much matter whether you're looking at a Republican FCC or a Democratic FCC. You've got your media bureau who goes behind closed doors, and in this case, went behind closed doors and made a deal with Sinclair. Many people heard about the $48 million fine that they levied against Sinclair. Well, the $48 million fine was contrary to the judge's order and to the law. They didn't conduct that public hearing. It was a secret investigation. And they've done this before. The FCC in 2017 fined Sinclair $13.5 million because it wasn't labeling programs that it aired as sponsored content. It was putting stuff on the news, pretending it was news and it was really advertisement, and didn't label it as such. And there's many more examples of this. Basically, what keeps happening with Sinclair, in 2001, the FCC fined Sinclair for essentially playing the same shell game it's now been found to be doing again. They keep doing this over and over again. I've not talked about the shell game, have I? Let me back up.
I just wanted to remind everybody that we're speaking with reporter Sue Wilson, and you can learn more at her websites. One is MediaActionCenter.net, and the other is SueWilsonReports.com. Sue Wilson, go ahead, please continue.
What Art Bellendook did was he went into the FCC reports that every broadcaster has to file, and he also looked into Security and Exchange Commission reports. And he identified a market. In Baltimore, Maryland, there are three stations. There's WBFF, which is owned by Sinclair. There's WUTB, which is owned by Deerfield Media. And there's WNUV, which is owned by Cunningham Broadcasting. Now, the way the rules work, because they don't want any one broadcaster to have too much influence on any one community, is if there's eight stations or more in a market, then one company can have two TV stations. Here in the Sacramento market, KCRA also has Channel 58, and that's legal because there's enough stations in the market to allow that to happen. Well, in Baltimore, there's only seven stations. So why is it that Sinclair owns three? Oh, no, wait a minute. I didn't say Sinclair owned Cunningham and Sinclair owns Deerfield, did I? But they do. And that's what Art Bellenduck has proven. Now, you can go to Wikipedia, and Wikipedia understands that Sinclair controls all these stations. You can go to the station's websites in Baltimore, and you can see that all three have the Sinclair logo on them. And yet, the lawyers for Sinclair, who also represent Cunningham and also represent Deerfield, they say, oh, no, no, these are separate companies. We have management agreements with them. But what Art Bellenduck discovered was that there is way more to this, that Cunningham really is completely controlled by the Smith family, which started Sinclair. What he discovered also was Deerfield is run by a former Sinclair banker. The ties run deep, and there's very, very little doubt about who really is running these stations. But there's more. Sinclair owns basically all the assets of the stations. It's kind of a crazy game they're playing here. It's like the station doesn't own anything. Sinclair hires the employees. Sinclair actually controls these stations. So think about it. In a market like Baltimore, and there's others around the country, they're controlling three television stations illegally.
And Sinclair owns over 200 stations, I believe. They're in over 100 markets.
That's right. And let's not forget that this is the same company which illegally was putting fake news onto news shows. They were forcing their news anchors throughout the country
yes.
to read right-wing commentaries or lose their job. How do you think the news anchors feel about that one, Mickey?
They actually didn't much like it. From a couple of studies that I had read about employees at Sinclair, said that it wasn't going over very well. And there was a lot of attention paid to this a couple years ago, particularly, and it saturates these markets across the entire country, which is why what you're talking about right now is so absolutely crucial for media democracy.
It really is. And if there's anybody who is interested in finance who's listening right now, I want you to really key in on this, because I think this is the key of what I believe is going to bring Sinclair down. What Art Bellenduck dug up at the Security and Exchange Commission is that Sinclair has options to buy these Cunningham and Deerfield stations that it already controls. It has options that value these stations at far below their worth. In Baltimore, in November 2012, Sinclair used the Shell Deerfield to purchase WUTB for $2.7 million. So Sinclair basically buys this station for $2.7 million, puts it in a shell company. But for some reason, 2 years later, the Security and Exchange documents reveal that Sinclair had an option to buy that station back from its shell company for $330,000. Sinclair has an option to buy a station that it paid $2.7 million in this shell company for $330,000.
Sue Wilson, what in the FCC is going on here?
Isn't that a good question? There's one last little thing about these options. They have these little option deals all over the country, and they have option periods to buy these stations so they can own them outright. They no longer have to be in a shell company. They have option periods for as long as 48 years. Now, why would they do that? Could it be that what the game is they're really playing is they expect at some point that the media ownership rules will relax? And when they do, they can sweep in, own all of these outright, and dominate the television stations with their right-wing disinformation.
And Sue Wilson, the reason they expect it to happen is because people from the industry and friendly attorneys and so forth, people like Ajit Pai, end up over at the FCC and end up trying to do these kind of things and change the rules. I'd like to remind listeners you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We're talking to Sue Wilson of SueWilsonReports.com. We're talking about FCC, media law, regulation. Right now, we've been talking about Sinclair. After this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation with Sue Wilson. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we have been speaking with Sue Wilson of SueWilsonReports.com. She is also the founder of the Media Action Center at MediaActionCenter.net, putting the public back into broadcasters' public interest obligations. And we've been talking about that so far today on the program. Before the break, we were talking more about Sinclair Broadcast Group. And Sue Wilson, I wanted to go back to that because you had said that Sinclair had a 48-year window that enabled them to buy back the station. Could you again pick up from there?
Well, I think for any of us who have any kind of business sense, and I think for a lot of us perhaps who understand real estate, because real estate's an easy way to look at this, there's a couple games that they're running. One is they sell a house to their brother, and then they say, okay, I can buy that house back from you within any time in the 48 years for about a tenth of what I paid for it. Now, how do they get away with that? They're actually bankrolling the shell company. I'm not even getting in the weeds in this because I think it's a little too hard to understand. Bottom line is that my friend Arthur Bellenduk dug all of this up, and you can read this. You can read the entire 39-page petition to deny. And folks, a petition to deny is not a signature petition. This is a legal term. It's a petition to deny the station's licenses. And I have that linked at MediaActionCenter.net. I believe I have it linked at SueWilsonReports.com. Bottom line here is that here's what's going to happen, folks, unless you and I start rising and making some noise. What's likely to happen here is what almost always happens, which is the FCC is going to bury this. And 3 years from now, they're going to come back to Art Bellenduk and go, oh, well, you know, we're not going to take this up. That's why I got involved with this case. This is Art Bellenduk's wondrous work. This is a work of a lifetime. But I understand that if we don't get real people shouting about this, Sinclair is going to win. Now, here's the thing, folks. I've been playing this game with the FCC for more years than I want to admit. And what I've learned is that the Federal Communications Commission really does not respond to public pressure. The Federal Communications Commission does respond to congressional inquiries. And what we have to start doing is calling our congressman and saying, wait a minute, make sure the Federal Communications Commission hears this case. They illegally buried the deal that they made with Sinclair. That was supposed to be a public hearing, and they would not allow it to become public. What Art Bellenduk is doing is trying to revive this almost dead case and breathe life into it so that justice can be done for all of us. But he's not going to succeed unless we, the people, are willing to make a phone call to our congressman. So I encourage you, go to SueWilsonReports.com, go to the MediaActionCenter.net, There's going to be more news coming out on this, and I'll archive it over the next days and weeks and months. But if we, the people, get involved and, A, educate our lawmakers, because I'm telling you right here and now, most of them don't even have a clue that we have these rights and that they have any power over the Federal Communications Commission. If we can educate our lawmakers and make our lawmakers understand that we recognize Sinclair as a threat to the nation, we do not want to see this right-wing disinformation television company get more control. In fact, we want to prove that they don't have the character to have a single broadcast station, and none of them should be renewed, and they should lose every station license that they own, period. Somebody else in the community should have those TV stations. Somebody else in the community should be running the local news. Somebody else in the community who understands our communities like it used to be, not some mega corporation that cares about itself and its politics and its own bottom line, not about you and me.
Well, Sue Wilson, this is really crucial work, really media democracy in action by definition. So your work for decades has really focused on this and really focused on what's happening with the Federal Communications Commission and how they need to be pushed by Congress. But of course, as I mentioned earlier, maybe you can talk a little bit more about this too. There's the revolving door from industry to the FCC. So we have what's called regulatory capture. And again, this is another one of those kind of things, even though it's only a couple layers deep, it doesn't seem that the public is always very keenly aware. For example, when we were talking about the fake news flap and the forced top-down propaganda that Sinclair was having all of their anchors read across the country, not everybody studies media this way or pays attention, and so they see it in their own local station and they don't connect the dots. And of course, journalism is supposed to connect the dots, right? That's the whole purpose of it, is to try to help make sense of this. What things could you share with our listeners about how to follow better what's going on at the FCC? I mean, obviously, SueWilsonReports.com, MediaActionCenter.net, the great work that you do. But what are some other tips or some other things that you could share with our listeners that don't study this as much and are not steeped in it, certainly not the degree to which you are?
It's very, very hard because hardly anyone in the country is talking about this. Now, I have a friend that I'm going to plug a radio show on a radio show, Brad Friedman, bradblog.com, somebody who follows this topic and who talks about it on occasion. There's not a whole lot of other people who do. There are some groups, and I'm not going to name them, who talk about some issues, but they are more about fundraising for the group than they are about actually doing anything about it. I wish I had some magic wand to say, here's how you educate yourself about the FCC. Mm-hmm. I guess I will say this. You can go to SueWilsonReports.com, go to the very beginning of that, which I believe is 2009, read every essay that's there. It's information that seems to be far away from us. And what we've got to do, forget about the FCC, just come down to we the people own the broadcast airways and start there. Think about what's happened. We the people, think about what's happened with radio. And I'm so grateful to be on Pacifica right now. But once upon a time in radio shows, if you wanted to talk about a controversial issue, and in fact you were required to do so, but you had to provide an opportunity for the other side to have their say. It was called the Fairness Doctrine.
Can you explain that to our listeners? Because that's a really big deal.
It was really very simple, and I was a fledgling producer at the time it went out. And at KCBS Television in Los Angeles, I did an issue show. It was called At Issue. Very simply, we would choose hot issues of the day and book guests to come in and talk about them. And I wasn't actually required to put both sides on the air. I was required to offer an opportunity to put both sides on the air. And there were times when one side was saying, no, I don't think we want to come in and talk about it. And I'd say, okay, I'll just give the other side the whole hour then. And so this was a rule that really made for true discussion. Well, after they got rid of the Fairness Doctrine, we saw the rise of Rush Limbaugh. He would just put on his buddies and do his tirades. And really, he started the whole anti-Democrat, Democrats are bums meme. And there was nobody to push back. You weren't required anymore to put the other side on the air, and he didn't. In 1996, the stakes went up. In radio, and this is why we're battling this so much with Sinclair in television, it used to be, when Ronald Reagan was president, one radio company could own 40 FM stations and 40 AM stations. That was it. With the 1996 Telecommunications Act, you suddenly could own as many radio stations as you could buy.
Which was under the Democratic president, Bill Clinton.
Yes, it was. Which, again, sometimes this looks like it's partisan. I'm here to tell you this is bureaucratic. I will say this. I really do not think that Bill Clinton knew what he was unleashing when he signed that. But what he unleashed was all of a sudden, Rush Limbaugh, who was already on the air at 600 stations, was replicated by others like Sean Hannity, like Glenn Beck, like Laura Ingraham, like the rest, to where, do you have any idea how many listeners are on talk radio today, Nikki? 90 million listeners.
I remember listening to Limbaugh when I was an undergrad in college in the car on AM radio. I remember listening. This was after the Fairness Doctrine was removed, before the 96 Telecom Act. But I remember the prevalence of that and copycat shows was significant. I was back in Ohio and Pennsylvania. All the local AM stations, it was wall to wall all day long with this kind of stuff, from Limbaugh to the next copycat, on and on. Later in years, it went over to Michael Savage, it went over to Hannity, and then local people started, they would fill it in later hours or earlier hours where they'd have local people basically copying this. It was like 13, 14 hours a day with no rebuttal.
That's exactly right. And then I'm going to make 2 points about this. You know, I hate it when people call the Midwest the flyover states, because I grew up in Western states. And I call them the drive-through states. You think nothing of driving a couple hundred miles to the next town because they got a better shopping center. And what do you do when you're on that road? You turn on the radio. And the only thing there was to listen to for the past 25 years was right-wing talk. I've got one more thing to say, and that is that a lot of people are very upset about Fox News. And you should be. But I'm here to educate people. You have zero power over Fox News. Fox News is a cable network. Fox News is regulated as a business. It is not regulated as broadcasting is. We, the people, own the radio airwaves. So when you worry about Sean Hannity, who recently had his highest ratings, he got 4 million viewers on Fox News one night. He gets 14 million listeners on the radio. And we have power over radio if we only take it. I think I'll leave you with that.
Well, Sue Wilson, I appreciate you trying to guide us and tell listeners that we have power. We can reclaim the rights to our airwaves. Ralph Nader has been screaming from the rooftops about this issue for years. But again, you're right. Outside of activist circles, we don't hear a lot about these kinds of issues, and we're not reminded often enough. So, Sue Wilson, I want to thank you so much for reminding our listeners about these issues. You can learn more about Sue Wilson's work at SueWilsonReports.com, and she's also founder of the Media Action Center. That's a very important organization, and you heard today on the show Sue Wilson talking not only about a history of these issues regarding regulation through the FCC of our airwaves and what we can do about it. You've also heard some updates of very recent cases, including Sinclair Broadcasting. Sue Wilson, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show. Is there anything else you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, Mickey, I just want to say Project Censored does great work. And the easy primer on what I've been talking about today is Broadcast Blues. You can find it for free on YouTube. Spend the 75 minutes watching that. Be inspired. And let's act.
Again, SueWilsonReports.com and MediaActionCenter.net. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Up next, we'll hear from Nolan Higdon about HBO's foray into the fake news world, their new film, After Truth. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In our final segment today, we welcome back to the program Dr. Nolan Higdon. He is a media studies scholar. He teaches at California State University, East Bay, in Communications Department and History. He also, his most recent publications include United States of Distraction, that he co-authored with me for City Lights in 2019, and his new book, just out from the University of California Press, The Anatomy of Fake News, A Critical News Literacy Education. Nolan is also the co-host of the Along the Line podcast with Dr. Dreadlocks Nicholas Bayham III. He's also a longtime contributor to Project Censored's annual book and our website. And we also finished a film not long ago on the United States of Distraction, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. You can learn more at projectcensored.org. Well, Nolan Higdon, we have you back today to have you share your analysis, your expert analysis, based on a lot of the things that you've been doing the last several years, including in your new book, The Anatomy of Fake News. Fake news has really gotten a lot of attention since the 2016 news cycle. A lot of people have kind of thrown their hat in the ring about how to fight fake news. And of course, we've been talking about this at Project Censored for some time, that not all those who fight fake news are doing it for the same reasons or with the same rigor. Most recently, this story popped up again, this topic, because HBO had a very popular documentary called After Truth, Disinformation and the Cost of Fake News, that's now playing at CNN. And of course, the production behind this movie was actually done by someone at CNN. But let's talk a little bit first about the main points of your book and the Project Censored fake news documentary. And then I want to get into the details about what After Truth looks like.
Thanks for having me on the show. I think if you look at the United States of Distraction documentary that we have available for free and The Anatomy of Fake News, what you can glean from both of those is that fake news is a much more comprehensive problem than a single nation or news outlet or ideology. Fake news is all around us. It's affecting all of us, the most uneducated as well as the undereducated, are susceptible to believing these fake narratives. But in both of those, the documentary and the book, they argue the real solution is to provide people with the analytical skills to examine content and then make a determination about its veracity. We don't advocate for like the McCarthyite idea of making lists of good journalism versus bad journalism. Instead, it's about empowering people to use their skills to make determinations on their own.
That is a very important and crucial distinction among the many different orgs or groups that are talking about fighting fake news. As educators, we've been talking about the efficacy of critical media literacy and these kind of skills. These are the very ones you talk about in your book with a fake news detection kit at the end, after giving us both a theoretical deconstruction of those challenges of disinformation as well as a history of fake news. Right? Your book does all of those things. Now, what about this new film? I want to take this analysis that you have been arguing, and certainly something that we've put forward here at Project Censored, the importance of critical media literacy education. When you watched HBO's After Truth, Disinformation and the Cost of Fake News, what are some things that stood out right away? The movie starts out pretty powerfully.
Yeah, it's such a stark contrast from where my book is. I mean, the purpose of my book, The Anatomy of Fake News, was to give a comprehensive history to, and like you said, give a detection kit, a series of questions that you can do to find fake news. And it was meant to empower the reader. Where this documentary, I mean, it has really great, HBO's documentary that is After Truth, it has really great storytelling in that it gets deep in the weeds about Pizzagate and the lives of the people affected. And this is a very serious issue, and it pulls your emotional strings for sure. But the documentary itself really is selective in who it chooses to blame for the fake news problem, and very selective in its solutions. It seems to believe that if people would just have faith in the corporate press, whether it be like CNN or the Washington Post, this whole fake news problem would disappear. I mean, that was kind of the message I got.
It's also important to note that Brian Stelter of CNN is the documentary's executive producer. And I mean, there's some irony there in terms of importance of media literacy skills is to ask those kinds of questions. Why does someone want me to know this? Who is behind this? Who's supporting this effort? Starts at HBO, and then surprise, surprise, Stelter at CNN brings his own film to CNN. That's not a surprise, but it doesn't seem to be gaining a lot of attention in terms of the critiques of the film.
Yeah, and it's just intellectually bankrupt. CNN and Washington Post have existed. for decades at this point, and fake news has remained a problem. So they can't just simply exist and get rid of the problem, nor can people just gravitate toward them and all of a sudden fake news will no longer be a problem. And I think that the way they set it up is very misleading. And you really notice it in particular when they start getting into the weeds of who's at fault. They rightly point out that liberals are starting to become more active with the production of fake news recently, but they ignore that there's a long history there of people across the ideological spectrum disseminating fake news. They seem to really focus on conservatives. And similarly, when it comes to nations, they focus on Russia. And I'm aware of Russia's activity to disseminate fake news online. I'm also aware that it's a documentary and you cannot cover every single nation that's engaging in fake news, which there are tons. But to ignore that the U.S. takes part in this, that's a serious omission from a supposed documentary.
What's fascinating, too, is that I've seen a number of people who are media critics themselves or journalists that were taken in by the narrative of this film. It's a well-produced film, for sure. And, of course, there's some low-hanging fruit. They take pot shots at Alex Jones, which is certainly not difficult to do. Not saying it's not important to make those arguments and decry some of the many, many disinformative and misinformative stories that he's done over his career, more as an infotainer, I suppose. But it's not that they don't rightly call out some of the problems. But like you say, again, when they start talking about solutions, they kind of want to corral people more into their ratings pit, so to speak.
It's really a self-serving documentary in that sense, and I get why people are reacting to it positively. It's great storytelling. It has great visuals. It moves along quite quickly. So for all those reasons, I could see why you'd be watching it and think this is great. But if you really are familiar with the content or you analyze the message deeper, you quickly find that it really amounts to kind of a PR piece for the corporate press. It blames the internet for the problem of fake news, which again, in my book, I demonstrate existed long before the internet, although the internet has complicated it for sure. But the other thing I don't like is that it sort of just blames people for not going to the corporate press and believing what they say, rather than analyzing the ways in which fake news works and why people have a lack of faith in the corporate press in the first place. It wasn't like one day most Americans woke up and no longer trusted the press. It came from story after story coming out where they mismanaged their coverage of things like the 2008 recession or the 2003 invasion of Iraq, where the press simply just got it wrong.
How about the 2003 invasion of Iraq? Not just got it wrong, but Judith Miller at the New York Times, as we recall, was getting spoon-fed disinformation from someone who had a history of working with the Central Intelligence Agency in the region. Ahmed Chalabi, and that wasn't revealed. And her stories went out on over 100 papers out of the New York Times where those stories were repeated again and again. And that war still goes on to this day. Very important to note that many of these corporate outlets have been peddling propaganda and false stories for quite a long time.
That repeated pattern of when they get things wrong or their account of what's going on is different from your own lived experience, people start turning against a lot of the corporate press. And it's not that the corporate press necessarily is doing this perniciously. They're money-making entities. They've basically fired most of the journalists. They cover a limited set of giant markets, and they limit their guests to elites and celebrities who will garner attention. So it's a very narrow scope of what they actually cover. So when they're forced to cover something large that takes investigative journalism, they really lack the skills and personnel to accomplish it.
So this has been an ongoing challenge, and in the previous segment, I was speaking with Sue Wilson. She has for a long time been a major advocate of trying to protect the people's airwaves, particularly by challenging the FCC to do their job as regulators. Most recently, we were talking about Sinclair Broadcasting, talking about fake news in a top-down management position. They made the anchors across the country at Sinclair stations read the same statement about the problems of fake news, which is basically a top-down propaganda ploy to get people to watch their brand in a tactic basically similar to the one that we're seeing at CNN.
This is pervasive across all different media, news media, ideological spectrum, newspapers, radio, television. I think until Americans sort of accept that fact, it's going to be really difficult to combat fake news because you can't go fight it just in little select areas because you empower those other areas.
And of course, in the United States, a distraction fighting the fake news invasion, a lot of those solutions are certainly proposed. That film's available for free on YouTube and linkable through projectcensored.org. And again, in your book, The Anatomy of Fake News, you go through in your last chapter a 10-point process to save our democracy. I'm going to remind listeners of what a few of those steps are so we can leave people with, again, some more productive things that they can do to try to make themselves better informed.
The Detection Kit just has a series of questions I encourage people to ask when they encounter any news content, whether it be online, on television, the radio, whatever. First, ask yourself if you want to be a news user or a fake news disseminator, because if you're going to be a news user, you need to read and analyze content, not just share, like, or repeat what you hear. You need to investigate, and that investigation process comes with asking, like, who is the author of this piece? Who's the company or outlet that's publishing it? What evidence is provided? What evidence is missing? What voices are there? What voices are missing? Is this person practicing journalistic ethics as far as the way it's written and the way it's introduced? Are the sources on the record, off the record? All of those are really crucial questions to consider before you determine the veracity of a piece of news content. It doesn't matter if it's a supposed mainstream or traditional press, or if it's a press outlet you've never heard of. These are questions you should ask for everything you encounter. And I think that's a more productive way to address fake news than just having blind faith in particular media outlets.
And if listeners are curious, you can read Nolan Higdon's review of HBO's foray into fake news. As he writes, it amounts to little more than corporate news propaganda, after truth, disinformation, and the cost of fake news. That's the new documentary that was on HBO, and that is also now on CNN. Again, Nolan Higdon, you argue in your work that the actual antidote to fake news is more critical media literacy education, critical thinking, and giving people these tools to help them sort it out. We don't need to listen to CNN or Sinclair to tell us what is and is not fake news. Thanks so much for joining the program today. Thanks for coming back to share your review with us on the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself along with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, of this program, also the host. Our co-host is Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest, our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity citizens, and the times for the master thief can find and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip the road.